Well, I'm glad we have so many guests because this will be a very easy introductory sermon. Is religion hardwired into the human brain? Yes. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, maybe I should explain a little bit more. We touched on it last week on issues of religion and what is religion, what are religions, are people. Do you have to believe in God to be religious? Do you have to follow rituals to be religious? What is it that we're talking about? And one of the things that I find really interesting is that we often mean different things. But underneath the differences, I find a tremendous sense of continuity. It's nice that we started with a reading from the Hindu tradition, because in Hinduism, they really touch upon the issue of what is universal and the appearance of diversity probably better than any other religious tradition, and you have to really get into modern physics to understand the kind of particularization that most human beings use to make an us versus a them. When I'm teaching comparative religion, I have what I call Dobra's first law. And being Dobra, I get to decide which is the first law. And it is that anything that you find in one religion, you find in every religion. That's practice, that is ritual, that is belief, that is us, them, anger, love, caring, neglect, because one of the common threads in all of the religions that we talk about, human beings. Our religions, whether they are secular or religious, whether they are about God or about history or action, essentially are about human beings and issues of connection to each other, to the source of life, to wonder, and context, where it is that we live in space, in time, and in history. I hate to fall back upon the National Rifle Association and have something in agreement, but when people look at religions and look at the religion's role in history and all of the anger, the animus, the wars, there is the temptation to say religion is the problem. And I guess I have this very simplistic view that religions don't kill people, people kill people. And that religions are inescapable. When I talk about it being something being hardwired in our brain, what I'm talking about is if we look at every human community over a period of history from the beginning of recorded history, and maybe even before the beginning of recorded history, we see the same urges and impulses. People trying to figure out, my goodness, what does it all mean? Why are we here? Why are we alive? Why are we breathing? Why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? Is there any order to the chaos? And human beings want to manufacture some kind of order to the chaos. Put it together, however briefly it holds together coherently, before it falls apart. One of the great problems in religious history and in human and political history is we build our houses of cards, and they're wonderful as houses of cards. They do really a good job for us for a while, and then we decide to lacquer them and shellac them and to bind these cards together with epoxy so that only my house of cards is the real and holy house of cards. And you are all terrible architects, and your houses of cards ought to be destroyed, while mine should be admired and worshipped. The problem, I submit to you, is not with the houses of cards, but it's with ourselves, our own kinds of insecurities. When we look at human beings, I think what makes us human is not simply our opposable thumbs, but the fact that we try to create some sense of order out of chaos, that we try to communicate, however tentatively, our sense of wonder at the fact that we exist, and then we try to give explanations. For me, the critical issues of religion are not about the explanations, it's the explanations that get us stuck and that get us angry. All right, I don't want to scare you, but I'm going to go biblical on you for a second. All right, a preacher's second. It'll take 3.5 minutes, which is kind of like a wife's 2 seconds. Anyway, are you ready? Yes, I just have to. Now you understand why she doesn't show up more regularly. Is that right?
This is what I come for.
This is what I come for. Okay. When you look at the Job story, Job is having a really bad incarnation. He's sitting there, he's lost his family, he's lost his flocks, he's lost all of this stuff, and he's sitting there really miserable, and his friends are hanging out with him, and they're really patient for a while, and he's really patient for a while, then it gets really rotten. And his friends start saying, you know, if God is just and you're being punished, maybe you're not as good a guy as we thought you were. It must be your fault that you are suffering. A little bit further on in the book, Job runs out of patience both with his friends and with God and gets up on his hind legs and charges God and says to God, hey, I played by the rules. I did everything. I was wonderful. I was worshipful. And this is the thanks that I get from you. God, why are you doing this to me? And God said,
where were you when I created everything out of the whirlwind?
Any attorneys here? Objection, non-responsive. It's a nice, deep, resonant voice, but it doesn't really answer the question of human suffering. At the end of the book, God restores everything to Job, and God is not at all upset that Job said, why are you doing this to me? But God was very upset with the people who interpreted why Job was suffering. What I take from this in a kind of living Unitarian Universalist religion is we get to ask all of the questions. We get to wonder at life, at science, at the world. We get to cry out in rage and in pain when bad things happen. We get to scream from the depths of our souls, why? And that is not impiety. But what we don't get to do is give a theological answer for suffering, because that leads to tragedy. So that the untouchables are untouchable because they're being punished for something from a previous life. So that the victims of this flood were not pious enough, and the victims of this famine were not pious enough, and the poor are poor because it's part of some divine plan. As soon as we start taking the responsibility for healing the world and living our own values off ourselves and putting it out there in the universe and saying the universe is just, we end up creating theological horrors. It's theological malpractice to look at the world and say, well, you know, you just couldn't possibly understand what God's larger view is. That's not religiosity. When I'm talking about religion being hardwired, a lot of people come and say, well, John, you know, those Unitarians seem to be pretty good guys, but, you know, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. I think that for full and completeness for human beings, we need bunches of compensatory systems. That living alone in just spiritual meditation without contact and connection and correction from a human community is an extraordinarily lonely place to be. I think that living just in the moment, cut off from past and cut off from future, without a longer story of a nation, a people, a movement, is also a very small and lonely place to be. I think religion does two things at its best. One of them is to connect us with each other. Religare, to be bound up together. And religare, religio, to be bound up together. And religare, to care for each other. That religion ultimately is not what I believe or you believe or you believe about God or afterlife or salvation. It is what we practice in our lives. So much of what we call religion gets lumped into this area of faith and of belief. And you're asked to believe some story more literally than you may be comfortable in believing it, instead of mining it for a sense of meaning. I think we try our best to practice our faith. Our faith that we are connected, that those waves of particularization and of diversity need not be threatening, that it may be possible to have an us without having an evil them, and that it might be possible in small moments to connect to those people that we want to make thems kind of instinctively and find the common threads that weave us together and celebrate the other threads that make life and religious life something rich and a tapestry that is not just dull pablum. Religion and being religious is not simply about the externals. Most of the religious prophets talked about things like this. It isn't about how loud you confess your faith. It's about what you actually do. You can pray 5 times a day and still be a miserable person. You can go to confession and then go right out and not learn a thing. You can have all of your sins wiped away and then say, oh good, I've got a good board upon which to write all my new ones. Or we can use the rituals not to erase guilt, and not to replace what is real worshipfulness, but to understand worship at its root, which is things that are of worth. To take things that in our lives and in our values we find internally to be worthwhile and to share them like a ruby, to offer them up to be admired and shared and take inspiration from, not something that we own or control or we deprive others of having, or others must see the same reflection in that ruby that we do or there's something wrong with them, but to take all of the sources of inspiration and to use them to energize ourselves to be connected with each other and connected with life and the source of life and existence, however we understand it. One of the things that is so often the case is that we seem to be talking about different things, because as we touched upon last week, so many people understand religion as a creed. This is what you must believe about God and about afterlife, and this is what you have to believe about all the people that don't believe the way you do. That's not the common thread that runs through the great teachings that we as Unitarian Universalists look for and try to extract from Hebrew scriptures, from Christian gospels, from the Pauline letters, from the Gita, from the Quran, from all of the writings of human beings who have searched this world for some sense of explanation. do we create meaning or do we uncover meaning? Is that great question to which I don't have an answer, and I'm not at all bothered by not having an answer. Once upon a time, when I was being quizzed by a panel of Unitarian Universalist clergy, I was asked the big question. So, John, do you believe in God? And my answer was, depends on what you mean. Which God?
Charlton Heston?
Which God? The gray beard white guy up in the throne that says, please pray to me and please make sacrifices to me at one moment, and then says, I'm sick of your sacrifices at the next moment, and then does a sacrifice in the next book. That God? Or a sense that life has meaning, and what we choose and what we do today either creates it or uncovers it. And as long as we affirm together that what we do to hold and heal and help each other either creates it or uncovers it, that's good enough for me. We can have different pictures in our heads. We can be informed by different music. We can be inspired. Back to hardwiring for just a moment. First time I heard Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto in D, I wept. I don't know why. There was something in those vibrations as they changed that touched something in me. That wasn't a context. It wasn't about it being Russian. It wasn't about a particular affinity that I have for the violin. It wasn't anything that, as far as I know, that I either ate or drank that night. But when I heard it, it touched something inside of me, and tears started to flow. Not picking, but referencing my wife. We were in Costa Rica, and she was looking at these birds, and they were extraordinary colors, and she began to weep. There are things in nature and sounds that somehow we are potentially responsive to if we open ourselves up to feel and to connect. To me, the religious life is not about what I call myself. It is about how I am open to connect to other people of all faiths and religions, how I'm open to see the good and to judge the things that are not good, but to see the humanity across a spectrum of religions and races and ethnicities. And it is also the context, the sense that we are a part of a human journey that began before our births, that go on beyond our deaths, and that what we do here and now with and for each other is passed on and is part of what makes tomorrow happen. I'd like to say that I've always believed that despair is a cheap emotion. I don't know that I always believed that, but I believed for a long time that despair is self-indulgent. It's a place to visit, but not a place to live. Because when we despair, we run out of energy to engage the world. It just becomes too big, too complex, and all of those other people and all of the forces of history are going to do whatever it is that they're going to do, and I'm just going to be a spectator. If you believe that you are of worth, if you believe that you have intelligence and judgment, if you believe that there is some power that goes from your hearts to your hands, then sitting it out is not a religiously responsible thing to do. As Unitarian Universalists, we are called upon to practice our faith, to practice our belief that this life has value, that human beings have dignity and worth. We will disagree over how to practice it, and that's fine. We will disagree about how it is that we will build those bridges. I love the bridge song. I remember I had a guest minister in when I was still in divinity school and I was serving a church, and I had a guest in who was an experienced minister, and he came to this my lovely little congregation that was basically, in the Bible it says that the beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord, and somebody once said God and three people got up and walked out. So that's fear of the Lord. They were pretty practical folk, teachers, engineers, and so forth. And it was the 60s reacting against the ultra-religiosity of some others. So this minister came in and he gave this lovely sermon about how we should build bridges. We should build bridges of understanding. And the talk back, I'm not making this up. I wish I could make this up. Well, in your sense, is that a suspension bridge that you're talking about? Or would you build the kind of bridge where you put the pylons in every couple of yards? And are we talking about the aesthetics or the practical? They got off into 20 minutes of talking about the engineering and the architecture for the bridge. I want to tell you, that's as crazy as people fighting about do we cross ourselves with two fingers or three fingers, pray on one knee, two knees, flat on the floor, standing, bending, bowing. I mean, that's missing the point. The point is not the architecture. The point is we the people, we the believers in life, we the believers in each other, we the believers that these few precious moments of life, of intelligence that we share together, we make more precious by being connected with each other and by understanding the context, the historic context of how we are connected, past and future, person to person, faith to faith. Find a society without a story. Find a society without some sense of good news. It is universal. It is universal. The question is not if we will be religious. The question is how we will use our beliefs, our identities, and our histories. Whether we will use them to tear down bridges, to tear down people, or to open up ourselves to each other and all of our sisters and brothers with whom we live today and those who will come after us. That impulse, that generous impulse, I believe, is hardwired within us, and it is part, much more importantly than the thumbs, of what makes us human beings.